I'm Christopher Lydon with Michael Lewis, the great tailspinner of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, and now The Big Short. All of them moral fables of our time, set and cast on the playing fields of Big League Baseball and Wall Street. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one, Michael, is about your classic, I think, in a form that is you by now. It's a story of the unraveling of the multi-trillion dollar bond market in American home mortgages, but by implication, it's about vastly more than that. I think it's about a world on the edge, and many edges: climate collapse, moral ruin, everlasting war, apocalypse maybe. And it's about the people who feel it in their bones, as well as in their analyses of the numbers. People, in this case, who bet against the market and all the myths around it. Would you just start with three groups of people in this book? There's Michael Burry, a former doctor in San Jose, California, determined to bring this market down. Steve Eisman, out of the Wall Street world, really, in New York, also betting against everything. And then three guys, the sort of garage band hedge fund, onto the same notion. What is it that drew you to these guys?
I was trying to describe the attitudes, the approach to the markets that was somehow had gone missing from the center of the financial system. The financial system over the last 4 or 5 years had organized itself around this giant bet. And on one side of the bet, betting on the subprime mortgage bond market, was the vast majority of the people in the financial system. And on the other side were these handful of oddballs who were betting against it. And the kind of question was, why these people? Why did they see what other people couldn't see? Why did they see that this market was doomed? And the more I kicked around with them, the more I came to see that their decision to make this bet against the financial system was very deeply rooted in either their experiences or their character or their or theories about financial markets. And I also came to see that if I could describe these people, I would be describing traits that really should have been present in the financial system that weren't. It was a way of describing the financial system by describing the holes in it. These people were people who were not part of the mainstream. They were not clubbable. They were not, their views were not heard or listened to, but they were right. And so
it's a very funny combination of qualities. Mike Burry has Asperger's syndrome. He's kind of a misfit. He doesn't relate to people. Steve Eisman on the other coast is, I mean, he's on the verge of Tourette syndrome, the way he bursts out a kind of revulsion. But there's also a deep moralism in these people. They know that something, it's not just that the bet is wrong, that there's something corrupt and sort of morally impossible on the other side of the game.
They think the society's falling apart. I mean, let's start with Michael Burry and why he, of all people, is the first to make the bet against the subprime mortgage market. He's not, by experience, by training, someone who is put on this earth to bet against bond market. He is a former neurologist who came to investing in the most curious way. I mean, he was blogging about it while he was a resident at the Stanford Hospital, and people found him. But what he was blogging about was finding value, finding companies that were undervalued that he could invest in. Very positive role for an investor. And it's in the process of doing this that he stumbles upon this great lie at the center of the financial system. He's looking at companies in the financial sector to invest in, and he realizes that he can't evaluate them unless he can evaluate this strange thing that's mushroomed, the subprime lending market. And the reason he becomes so gloomy about it all is precisely because he has Asperger's syndrome. He has no one around him. He has no face-to-face interaction with people, lives his life by email, cuts himself off from the rosy talk around this market. So he's not hearing any of the propaganda, and instead is looking just at data, just at numbers. You know, as he says, only someone with Asperger's syndrome would read a subprime mortgage bond prospectus. But and that's what he's doing. And he sees that one, the quality of the loans being made to middle-class Americans to buy homes is declining, and that the structure has gotten so bad, it can't get worse. The loans are being made where not only does the principal not have to be repaid, but the interest doesn't even have to be repaid. It just rolls into a higher principal balance. And he essentially diagnoses the financial system purely through data analysis. So this was something that was clearly not as prevalent inside the system as it should have been. More people should have just been looking at simple data and not listening to the propaganda around this market.
What's the Steve Eisman version of that personal story? I mean, he saw through it too in a different
way. But Michael Burry has no connection to people. He doesn't know what happens when a subprime mortgage lender tantalizes some Mexican immigrant with a $700,000 loan so he can buy a house.
I still haven't figured that out.
Yeah, but Steve Eisman does. Steve Eisman is the first analyst on Wall Street to write reports about subprime lending companies back in the mid-90s. And he actually had an on-the-ground, pretty felt understanding of this interaction between high finance and middle America. In analyzing those companies, that the first wave of subprime lenders, all of which went bankrupt, he discovers lots of examples of not just bad business practices, but fraud perpetrated on individuals. I mean, that people kind of deceived into taking loans that they should never have taken out. And he becomes outraged that this exists and turns on the market he's meant to be sort of promoting as an analyst on Wall Street. Actually stands up in the middle of a Wall Street trading floor and lists the names of all 13 of the major subprime mortgage lenders and predicts to the sales force that they're all going to go to zero. And he's right. And he turns out to be right.
But stood up there with a zero in his finger and thumb and said,
it's all going to be worthless. But you know, what was interesting about him to me, his wife was very important in kind of explaining him to me. He had started his life on Wall Street as kind of a shallow cynic, and he was participating in the game. And he didn't ever really imagine horrible things happening in the U.S. economy or the U.S. financial system. He had a life experience that actually turned him. His first child was killed when he was smothered by a night nanny when the child was 6 weeks old.
Accidentally, right?
Well, it's never been determined, actually. Right. And as his wife said, at that moment, my husband changed as a person. He became someone who could imagine a radically different world than the one we live in, and one in which bad things do happen. And it was after that he stood up and said, these subprime mortgage originators are all going to zero. And I think that actually a personal tragedy prepared him to see a financial tragedy. That it required an active imagination on the part of any investor to be able to see that this thing that was going on in the subprime lending market could lead to genuine catastrophe. And then the whole financial system could be reordered. That the world just wasn't going to chug on as it had chugged on for a long time. And so the question is where that capacity for imagination comes from. And I think one of the places it can come from is that sort of traumatic life experience.
Mm. Can you sketch the three guys in the Bay Area in an attic, in effect? Let's call them Charlie, Jamie, and Ben. But this is the Garage Band, and they are of an entirely different generation. They're amateurs, really, and yet they're onto something.
Yes, they're amateurs, but in a funny way, also sophisticates. They start with $100,000 in a Schwab account in their late 20s, early 30s, and they have a theory about financial markets. They basically think that that the financial system is making a systematic error, that it is underestimating the likelihood of really unlikely events, underestimating the likelihood of catastrophe or miracles. And so that there are these bets that are available to be made in the financial system. Technically, they're called options. You buy out-of-the-money, long-dated options is what they were called. But you can think of it as just long-shot bets where the odds are, say, where the bet is priced at, say, 50 to 1. And you put a dollar down to make 50. You don't have to be right every time. You just have to be right enough of the time for it to be a useful strategy. And this is what they did. They started literally wandering the world looking for anything, commodities, currencies, stocks, where there seemed to be, the market seemed to be discounting the possibility of something really dramatic happening. And they made these long shot bets, and they turned $100,000 in the Schwab account into $12 million over a period of a few years. And then they stumbled upon this thing called a credit default swap on a subprime mortgage bond, which is priced as a long shot bet. It is, you buy insurance for a couple of percent a year on a pool of subprime mortgage loans, and if they go bad, you get paid 100. So it's a 50-to-1 bet. And they start digging into it, asking themselves, are those the right odds for this thing? And the more they dig into it, the more they think, oh my God, not only is it not the right odds, this isn't even a long shot. This whole system's going to come down. They're sort of innocents, though. They don't know anything about this market. They don't know how it works. So they have to sort of investigate the way, almost the way a child would. And they ask really simple questions, and they get back lots of nonsense. And they quickly go from thinking, oh my God, we found a great bet to make, to thinking, oh my God, the system's going to collapse. Democracy's at risk. Mm. They're terrified. All of these characters have this journey where they stumble upon this thing that's going on at the heart of the financial system, and it just takes them a while to believe it could be as bad as it is.
Michael Lewis, let's get to the Michael Lewis dimension here. I mean, it took me a while to figure out after Moneyball and Bias Broker that Michael Lewis is not a finance writer. I don't read finance books, and you're not a sports writer either. I do read sports books, but this hits home for entirely different reasons. To me, it's that these are examples of hunches that we all have about many, many things. That we're swimming around a drain, that our food is poison, that our schools are killing real learning, that the culture has turned toxic, that the climate is really in trouble. Speak to the understory here, or the overstory that you're telling. I'm not saying that all of those things are real, but this is about the fear of apocalypse in a way.
Yes, that is absolutely true. It is absolutely true that all the characters in the story play the role of sane man in the insane world. None of them know each other. None of them have the solace of thinking that there's someone else who thinks the way I do. So it's like the first scientist who discovers climate change and is trying to explain to people that this is actually real and nobody will listen. It's a terrifying experience because, of course, their first impulse is in every case to think, I must be missing something. It can't be true that what the financial system is doing is this catastrophic. But the more they investigate, the more they discover that it is true. So that anxiety animates all the characters.
The interesting thing, though, Michael, and it's a puzzle to me, is that this is not just a matter of reading the data. It's a matter of having a temperament, an emotional life, that lets you hear the data.
Yes, that's true.
It's one of the GarageBand guys, I think, who's aware that he's always looking to the chances of extreme change or of personal disasters in real life. He's waiting for it, in a sense.
Well, and they're also very alive to other people's false sense of certainty, that the system was premised on the idea that basically the bosses knew what they were doing, that markets knew how to price risk, and that there was a sense of complacency and certainty at the center of it that alerted them to the possibility of opportunity. Mm. That they themselves thought that the key to their success was their willingness to live in a state of uncertainty, their willingness to understand that there were things you just couldn't know, and that other people's false certainty was a mistake they could exploit. Of course, the problem is that once you've been right over and over and over again, that you start to develop your own self-certainty. And they it's interesting to me the way they ward with their own confidence. They're increasingly right, they're increasingly rich, and yet they know that in order to remain successful, they have to remain in a state of perpetual self-doubt. It's very hard when you're a success to be self-doubting. But the broader thing about all these characters to me is that their attitudes, their approach to life, their ability to hear the data, was something that was marginalized in the system itself. They didn't belong. None of them belonged. And they should have belonged. What is it about the system that that doesn't want them as a part of it. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying when all the people who are wrong are in charge and all the people who are right are on the outside.
It sure is. To me, there's a direct analogy to be drawn with the war in Iraq, say. I mean, the Congress signed off. Oh, well, he must know something. Tony Blair encouraged it. You know, the media, by and large, encouraged it. Very, very few people said, are you kidding? And yet, the ones that warned of the war in Iraq got the same prize that your guys got for warning of the meltdown.
Yes, which was ostracism.
Exactly. And they're still ostracized.
It's funny. There is an analogy. And the analogy is there's a kind of a blind faith in leadership that is the result, in both cases, of ordinary people feeling they basically can't evaluate the situation because it's too complicated. That right. The financial system got so complicated and the complexity became opacity. When Alan Greenspan stands up and says something, no one understands what he's saying, but they think that's a good thing because it is also complicated. They shouldn't understand what he's saying. And the fact is they should. The fact is that if things aren't being explained in a way you and I can understand them, it should be a bad sign, not a good sign. But the complexity was turned on its head. It was used as a way to mask bad things that were happening. There's a joke in it all, and the joke is that the financial system, and there are analogies to the political system, but the financial system wanted to do something it really shouldn't do. It wanted to make lots of loans that it shouldn't make, that created all this risk that was going to blow up the system. In order to do that, it needed to disguise the risk. So to disguise the risk, it used all this complexity, which served as a smokescreen. And the joke is that it ended up disguising the risk from itself, that the very people who created the smokescreen were engulfed in it, and they couldn't parse the system they created.
That's a big point. There's a little point also in the fact that Mike Burry, who held out against the myth and almost lost, he was under terrible pressure from his investors. You know, get real. You're wrong, Mike. But he held out. He was eventually proved entirely right. He made huge returns for those investors, and they froze him out.
Yes.
They didn't call and say, thank you, Mike, for hanging in.
No one thanked him. Yeah, it's a very rare story where, in the financial world, where someone makes a lot of people rich and everybody still hates him, and he hates them. Usually when you get rich, everybody's happy. In this case, people got rich and they were sort of unhappy because of the drama involved leading up to it. Michael Burry said in 2005, I can't in good conscience continue to do what you've hired me to do and simply invest in stocks. You can't do it because this thing that's going on in subprime lending is going to overwhelm the value of the stocks. And so he started to do different things with his investors' money, and they didn't understand it. And they were upset that he was doing something different. And they were upset to the point that they started to pull their money back away from him. And he invoked this very, it was a legitimate thing to do, but it was it disturbed his investors. There was a clause in his contracts that said that if he had an investment that was illiquid that he couldn't sell, he could just keep it, and they couldn't have their money back. And he said this about his bet against subprime mortgages: I'm just going to keep, against your will, I'm going to keep this bet on. You can't have your money back, because it was a bet always that was going to take a couple of years to work out, and you're just going to have to wait. And they thought of all these threats of lawsuits. They basically severed ties with him in every way, except he kept this bet on. And the bet works out, and they all get rich, and nobody's willing to say, I was wrong. Nobody's willing to say, you were right. They all rationalize their bad behavior towards him in various ways instead. And he ends up being driven out of the business. I mean, he ends up deciding, this is not something I want to do. As gifted as he is in it, he doesn't want to be in the investment business.
Nobody thanked Mike Burry. And this is where I come back to Iraq. Nobody thanked Robert Byrd of West Virginia for standing on the Senate floor day after day and saying the war in Iraq will be a moral and strategic and in every way a disaster.
Yeah,
he still can't make page one of the New York Times.
You know, it's funny this, because you would think that in a sane world, the people who were right and who tried to stop us from doing that would be celebrated. But of course, what happens is just the opposite, that whatever emotional positions people take in the beginning, whether it's hostility to people who were against the war in Iraq or hostility to Michael Burry for being right about the subprime mortgage market or making his bet against the subprime mortgage market, They're stuck with that position. They become defenders of that position. And rather than change their position, what they do is they create another narrative to justify the way they felt in the first place. So in the case of Michael Burry, the story that the investors who he made rich tell themselves is he behaved unethically, he was difficult, or he didn't communicate well, or it was still his fault that we didn't like him in some way. And so it's easier to change the story than it is to change the way you think about something.
This is the interesting thing about the world of today. The people who sold us the war in Iraq are still telling us what's wise foreign policy. The people who created the meltdown are still running the economic
system. This is an incredible thing.
And at the same time, you have this reflected, I suppose, in the Tea Party, but in lots of other symptoms, you have this huge disbelief boiling up in the whole society about the whole range of authority, it seems to me.
Yes. This is a great puzzle about the financial meltdown. What we learned in September of 2008, when Lehman Brothers went down and the federal government flopped about trying to figure out what to do about it, is it became very clear that anybody who was in a position of leadership, running a big Wall Street firm, senior at the Treasury, senior at the Fed, had no idea what had just happened. They had missed the central drama in the financial system. And yet, they were, by virtue of their positions, the one left to sort out the mess. They were the ones left to devise a solution. And it was a public policy version of what happens on Wall Street a lot. That people who create crises on Wall Street often make a fortune cleaning them up or responding to them in some way because they're the ones who know the most about the problem. So, I don't know, back in the 80s, the people who created the junk bond market at Drexel Burnham, they created a lot of problems. But when the market falls apart, they themselves become very valuable because they know the securities they created and they go work at some other firm, finding the good ones. People right now who created subprime mortgage bonds that went bad are making lots of money investing in distressed subprime mortgage bonds because they're the ones who know about them. And the public policy version is sort of the people who were responsible for orchestrating the crisis, that they are, because they're on top and they're in the middle of it, they're the only ones who are sort of fluent in the language of it. I mean, who is to question Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, about this or that, because he's the only one with the information kind of thing, even though he is clearly culpable in what happened.
Not to mention Larry Summers and Bob Rubin and all the other architects of the deregulation.
Yes, yes.
They're still calling the shots in a new administration after a change of party management. I mean, it's unreal.
It is unreal because basically, but all of the people you mentioned all swallowed a general view of Wall Street, which was that it was a useful and worthy master class, that these people basically knew what they were doing and should be left to do whatever they wanted to do. And they were totally wrong about that. Not only did they not know what they were doing, but the consequences of not knowing what they were doing were catastrophic for the rest of us, that it was not just not useful, it was destructive. I mean, we live in a society where the people who have squandered the most wealth have been paying themselves the most, and the failure has been rewarded in the most spectacular ways. And instead of saying we really should just wipe out the system and start fresh in some way, there is a sort of instinct to just tinker with what exists and not fiddle with the status structure. And I don't know whether that's going to work. I mean, when you look at what Alan Greenspan did or what Larry Summers did or what Bob Rubin did, there are individual acts, individual mistakes they made, like, for example, not regulating the credit default swap market, preventing that from happening. But the broader problem is just the air they breathe. The broader problem is just the sense they all seem to have that what's good for Goldman Sachs is good for America.
You know, I asked Simon Johnson a rude question the other night. He didn't want to answer it because it's about Larry Summers. But I said, you know, Robert Rubin took over the sort of financial side of the Clinton administration. And after that, he took over Harvard, really, with the appointment of Larry Summers as president. Harvard took a long look at Larry Summers, and basically the Faculty of Arts and Sciences voted no confidence and sent him packing. Washington doesn't seem to be able to muster the same kind of judgment. Like, that didn't work. We're going to go another way. Thank you, Larry. And my question to Simon Johnson was, what could Harvard teach the Inside the Beltway crowd about making fundamental change or acknowledging a mistake and doing it differently?
Well, I have some sympathy for Larry Summers running Harvard. I can't imagine just generally running a large university is, I don't know, like running an NBA basketball team, and that you've got all these people you can't fire who you're supposed to be the boss of. And you don't have the levers to really run the institution in a conventional way.
But then it wasn't conceived as a corporation anyway.
No, I know. But so I'm not sure I go looking to the Harvard faculty for answers to this problem.
I wouldn't need it normally, but...
But it is... It's a very curious thing that the very institutions that jeopardized our welfare are the ones who are sitting at the table to decide what to do about themselves. And so the question is, how does Washington move away from those institutions and make decisions that are in the public interest without regard for the welfare of these institutions? It's a hard question because, I mean, this is the problem, that essentially the public and their representatives have been buffaloed into thinking that this subject, financial regulation, structure of Wall Street, is too complicated for amateurs. That the only people who are qualified to pronounce on this are people who are in it. And there are very, very, very few people who aren't in it in some big way who have the nerve to stand up and fight it. And I mean, Paul Volcker is an example of someone who is not really in it, but who realizes you don't have to be in it to understand it. And he's been kind of a lone voice. The representatives, the elected representatives, look at the financial system, I'm sure, and they think, it's too complicated for me to understand. I'm going to be quickly exposed as a know-nothing if I take the lead on regulation. And in the bargain, I'm going to miss out on all these campaign contributions from the financial institutions because I'll alienate them.
Meantime, the popular anxiety, I think, grows. I mean, we hear announcements of a recovery, all these, you know, green shoots kind of talk. But a lot of people I know, I think people on the street think we haven't heard the worst of it.
They're absolutely right. I mean, I've been traveling the country the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, tell me.
And, you know, normally when I write a book, I go out and there are people who are interested in the book. In this case, I write a book and there are people who are interested in the cause. I mean, the events I've been doing have been huge and they've had a political tenor to them. That people are just generally very, very, very upset at Wall Street. And these are not... the unpropertied classes, that who's typically, you know, in the ballroom are independent financial advisors, accountants, small businessmen, regional banks. They all feel disenfranchised, and they're right to. Essentially, what's happened is that at the top of the society, we've made a decision to subsidize a few enormous firms, and there's the huge cost to that subsidy is to punish everybody who's not part of the huge firms. It's a sort of petty bourgeois revolt that's waiting to happen. You can see it. I just kind of wonder how that dissatisfaction, that anger, I mean, it is anger. And it is powerful, gets channeled politically. I mean, the Tea Party is, I think, partly an expression of it, but it doesn't fully capture the nature of the anger. The anger is, it's almost a kind of class warfare anger. Yeah. And it's the root of it is, essentially, we've created a system where there is socialism for the elite and capitalism for the rest of us. Mm. And for a very small elite, we have created a kind of entitlement culture where no matter what they do, if they're sitting in that firm, they're entitled to be rich and everybody else has to sort of fend for themselves. Mm. And so, on the one hand, that creates an awful lot of anxiety in people's part to get themselves into that elite. But it also creates a lot of anger at being and frustration if they aren't in that elite. And it's unfair. It's fundamentally unjust. Socializing the downside for these people and privatizing the upside. That if they get to keep their winnings, but their losses are our losses. It's a terribly unjust system, and it eats at the heart of the most ardent capitalist.
Yeah. This is serious. One of your GarageBand guys, Charlie Ledley, says at some point, this is 2 or 3 years ago, but he sees this tissue of lies that's holding this thing together in a way. But he wonders, what are the implications for democracy? That is to say, for free people governing themselves with reasonably good information and some regard for community.
What he and his partners conclude is that the financial system is rigged. It's a rigged game. And if that's true, and they're very persuasive on this subject, I think it is true. It became a rigged game. It's still a rigged game. But in order for the financial system to survive, it requires people to trust it, to have faith in it. But how can you have faith? How can you trust a rigged game? Well, you can't. You can have a kind of false, tenuous confidence in it, but it's hard to have a genuine faith in it. I think that's what we're stuck with right now. That's why the uncertainty that's in the air is essentially the uncertainty that accompanies false confidence, that we've got a kind of bravado about our system, but it's basically a broken system. But their interests start to extend to politics. I mean, Charlie Ledley is actually all these characters in some weird way aren't money people. And Charlie Ledley's not a money person. His real passion is public policy. He's more interested in public education than he is in running a hedge fund. And Charlie just, you know, he naturally thinks, well, what are the political consequences of people, of the economic system being regarded as a failed system by the population? It's potentially catastrophic. I mean, there's going to be people storming the streets. It's funny because they made their money by following, by sort of warring arguments to death, by taking an argument and following it to its natural conclusion. And the natural conclusion that their argument about the subprime mortgage market leads them to is, my God, we need to put our money into gold and put it under our mattress. And that's it's a very odd place for someone to go who is not naturally an extremist. But this is where their thinking leads them.
Michael Lewis, this is such a funny book, too. Your characters say wonderful things, like Vinnie Daniel at a meeting in Las Vegas of mainly focused on the rating agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's. He says, the question was, did they know what they were doing? Were they just thugs? And he says, there were more morons than crooks, but the crooks were higher up.
Yes. I love yes. that. Yes. And this is a running argument in the minds of the people who are discovering just how bad things have gotten in the financial system. And it's an argument they have with themselves. Are they fools or are they crooks? Because those are your choices. Once you realize what's going on, you have to decide, are they foolish or are they crooked? And the answer that they come to in their own minds is a bit of both, but more foolish than crooked. And in a way, it's the most terrifying revelation that people could be so deluded that it isn't that they're consciously cheating the system, that they actually believe these lies that they've told themselves. And they over and over, they sort of have to resist their own impulse to think that everybody's a crook, because the evidence is they actually, that the nonsense coming out of people's mouths, they actually believe it.
Can I say, these guys are on to sort of a literary touches, too. At one point, there's a guy from Deutsche Bank, he's an American named Greg Lippmann, who is also betting against the game, and nobody trusts him. And you compare him, well, they compare him to the unreliable narrator in a novel. They believe his story, but they don't believe him.
Right. Greg Lippmann was God's gift to a narrative nonfiction writer, because he was basically the only person inside a big Wall Street firm who had a very negative view about the subprime lending machine. He was, at the same time, even though he was inside Deutsche Bank, he was outside Deutsche Bank. He was widely loathed by his colleagues. He was regarded as this outrageous character. He was very vocal about the fact that he didn't really, you know, yes, Deutsche Bank wrote him his paycheck at the end of every year, but he had no particularly loyalty to the place, and he would leave in a moment's notice if he felt like it. He was, but he, in late 2005, makes a big bet against the subprime mortgage bond market, which is a very odd thing for a trader who's supposedly the head of subprime mortgage bond trading in a Wall Street firm to do. He's betting against his own market. And then he runs around the world looking for people to join him in the bet, trying to sell people on the idea of trying to collapse his market. No one on Wall Street does this. They're all promoters, basically. He was an anti-promoter. And what he's selling will end up being maybe the single smartest bet, the single most lucrative opportunity for an investor in the last century. And yet, because he comes from Wall Street, and nobody believes people on Wall Street, and especially because he comes from the bond market, and the bond market is known to be a mendacious, deceitful sort of place, no one believes him. So you have this weird situation where the guy who's selling the best ideas is regarded as totally unreliable. He adds to the problem just with his personality, that people meet him and they find him, they think he's a bit of a squirrely character. They can't really, don't know what to make of him. But in fact, what he is he's actually too transparent. He wears his motives on his sleeves. Most Wall Street people are hiding the fact that they are trying to screw you. He doesn't hide it at all. He explains to people how he's going to get rich off their business. He explains to people even how much money he makes, which is one thing you never do on Wall Street. And it alienates people. They would rather have his interests disguised. It was a really good example of how transparency and forthrightness actually works against someone in that system.
Well, it creates the interest in him, even among his colleagues. Danny and Vinny keep saying to each other, I know he's going to try to fuck us, but how and when? What's the trap?
They actually would ask him that question directly. How are you going to screw us? We know you're going to screw us. Tell us how and we'll deal with you. And he keeps trying to tell them how until finally they're satisfied. It's the only reason they will not enter into this bet. They assume if it's coming from him, it must be wrong in some way.
One more literary question for me. Orhan Pamuk, the Turkish novelist, gave a series of lectures last fall in which the whole point was that every novel has a center. And it's the great trick to write it, but also to find it as a reader. And it's not about the plot. It's not the characters. It's somewhere about the light in a book, the landscape, the moral atmosphere. And so I'm trying to read new ways. Where's the center of any serious book I'm reading? In your case, the center is an atmosphere of deep anxiety and unfinished business. And I think it's the book resounds because that's where we all are. And it's very, very complicated about our politics, about our environment, not to mention our money. Am I close?
Yes, you are close. And it's you do discover things while you're writing them that you weren't aware of until you wrote them. And one of the things I discovered was that the world we currently live in was only partially suited to the kind of writing I do. That I found myself time and again frustrated with the fact that the material was heavier rather than lighter, frustrated with the inability to play a scene for laughs. Because what I was describing was actually rather tragic, even though there was a dark humor in it somewhere, and also frustrated, but I mean, I had to go with it because it was the truth, with the fact that I had as heroes in a story, people who were betting on the end of the world, people who actually, against their instincts, in many cases, were twisted around to having to bet on tragedy in order to survive. And that that I was going to require the reader to be with such sort of complicated heroes was going to be difficult. All the way through the book, what I find with books, with stories, is that what you're looking for is the hole you leave for the reader to walk into. That you're looking for the important thing you're leaving out, and which will result in different people reading your story in completely different ways. And the hole in this book was, what the hell are we to make of people who make their fortune betting on catastrophe for the rest of us? And what kind of world do we live in where that's the best we can do for a hero? That is the closest thing you can find to a hero in the financial system are the people who are betting against it. It's an upside-down world, and an upside-down world is a very uncomfortable, uncertain, unstable place to be in.
You'd love a politer warning to sort of get out now or something.
Yeah, you would love Warren Buffett, or the idea of it, the idea that the hero is the person who's getting rich doing something that's good for all the rest of us, or whose interests are aligned with all of our interests, or who is doing well out of some good thing that's happening. But this is the consequence of the system we have agreed to live with. The consequence is that person doesn't really exist anymore. And that the only characters you can really trust are the people who are delivering a very, very dark message.
Michael Lewis, do we want President Obama to read this book?
I wonder if he has time to read any book, but I actually, when I wrote it, I thought it's a book that might serve him well because it's addressed to someone who doesn't necessarily know a lot about Wall Street, just trying to clarify some basic things that every citizen should know. And I have met him, and he has told me that he mentioned he read Moneyball. So I sort of hoped that it found its way to him, because I think it would help him shape his views about what to do.
He certainly campaigned on his own intuition, projected it beautifully, that this can't go on. We need some fundamental change here. But then what?
Well, then he's been captured by his banker, just like the ordinary Americans captured by their stockbroker. He's been buffaloed by the complexity of it all, and he doesn't have time to sort it out for himself, and he has to sort of trust the people who seem to know. The alternative is for him to set off on his own in a quixotic quest to reform the financial system without having any experience of the system. It's sort of like the presidential version of regulatory capture, that he is at the mercy of the people who really don't have probably his long-term best interests at heart, but who seem to know what they're talking about.
Michael Lewis, everybody marvels at the way you write and construct these stories out of your own intuitions, your own reporting, too. Especially for me, somehow those GarageBand guys, when you write about them, the reader is floating intuitively. It's much more like music than journalism. Do you want to give us the secret? Or tell us how you do it.
Yeah, it's horribly unsatisfying to describe. It's a very messy process. It's not formulaic. It really is a matter of sort of trying things out and seeing what works. And if there's a musical analogy, it's the analogy to maybe a jazz musician who doesn't know how to read music, just figuring it out on the keyboard as he goes along. I do it by feel. I don't know when I wade into a subject like this. I waded into it 2 years ago. I don't know what story I'm going to tell for some time. And the simple selection of the material, which is the first big decision, will often take me a year. And sometimes after I've selected the material, I'm doing it on a hunch. Only after do I figure out why I selected what I selected. Really writing is about, and this sounds strange, about leaving things out. The gift is to find, the luck is to find the right things to leave out. And what's the least you have to include to make it all work? It's a process of accumulating lots of raw material, sitting in my office by myself and figuring out how much I can get rid of.
Michael Lewis, we thank you for your work, and we thank you for this conversation. It's a real privilege.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to see you again.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.